What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For David Cameron's state visit to the U.S. this week, there was no Royal Air Force One. The new conservative British Prime Minister flew in on a scheduled flight and sat in business class. He told ABC's Diane Sawyer why.
You know, we've got a lot of money to save. We've got a very big budget deficit, so we can't go spending money on executive planes, sadly.
Sadly, he says, but boy, is he cutting. The British Prime Minister's frugal flying is more than a stunt. It's a big message to Britons back home that austerity is on, that Cameron is going to slash government spending in a serious, no kidding, some say savage way, draconian cuts across the board. They will touch everyone in the UK, even the Queen. This hour on Point, Britain's drastic change of course on public spending and debt, what it may bring, and how it looks from Washington. You can join the conversation this hour. Could Americans handle this kind of revolutionary rollback in public spending? Should we? Or would it croak our economy and the world's? Is Britain now free riding on American stimulus? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. The Prime Minister got into Washington on early this week, on Tuesday. He was talking with the President, Obama, at a joint press conference, joking about what he found most impressive on his tour of the first family's home.
I have to say I was most impressed by how tidy your children's bedrooms were. And I think if the President of the United States can get his children to tidy their bedrooms, then the British Prime Minister, it's about time he did exactly the same thing.
You have to give them notice. That's the only thing.
Right. Well, they've got notice.
The Prime Minister's coming.
They should be in bed by now, but if they're not, they have notice.
Tell them the Prime Minister's coming and clean up your bedrooms. But the message on economics and spending, quite different from Cameron and Obama. On Tuesday morning, NPR's Renee Montagne sat down with the British Prime Minister at the ambassador's residence in Washington. Although Great Britain is not in as much financial trouble as Greece, he said, his country is borrowing as much money this year as the Greeks are. That's why, said Cameron, he's calling for drastic measures.
It does mean some steep cuts in public spending. We have to do that, not because we want to, but because we want to safeguard the British economy and British society from the sort of problems that you do see in countries like Greece. And I think it's important for a country like ours. We're not a reserve currency. We're not the United States of America. We can't take our time with this. We have to get on with it and prove to the world and prove to ourselves that actually we can live within our means again.
Live within our means, again, the message from the British Prime Minister. We will talk in this hour with two big British economists who've come down on opposite sides of the UK's new austerity drive. But first, we turn to Philip Coggan in London. He's the Buttonwood columnist for The Economist. Philip Coggan, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom.
So, hot dogs in business class. These may be publicity stunts in a way, but you've got enormous cuts proposed and on the rails.
Yes, we have. And we have a big problem which dates back really to the last 13 years of the Labour government under Tony Blair and then Gordon Brown. When they took office, they were spending about 38% of GDP on public spending. When they left office, they were spending 47.5% of GDP on public services. So that was a huge increase over the period. And the net result is we've ended up, after the financial crisis, with a deficit of more than 10% of GDP in terms of the amount we have to borrow each year. Looked at another way, one in every £4 that the government spends, it has to borrow from the markets. So that's one reason why the government is determined to cut back. And it's not just a Conservative government, it's a coalition between the Conservatives and a minor party called the Liberal Democrats.
So here you've got the Conservative Prime Minister, 43 years old, your youngest Prime Minister in a couple of hundred years, just in office for 10 weeks now, and give us a sense of the depth of cuts he's talking about, up to 40% in the budgets of many departments there, 25% in the next 5 years, what, maybe 11% of all public employees off the payroll?
It could be. I mean, you can look at this in several ways. Okay, let me just take you through the numbers just briefly. Look at it in cash terms. In cash terms, they're actually going to spend more every year from the current year of £697 billion. That's about $1 trillion. And then in 5 years' time, they'll be spending £758 billion. So it's going up a bit every year. But of course, inflation eats away at that cash terms. So they
and you have inflation in the UK, unlike
the US. And we have inflation,
mm-hmm.
yeah. We have a headline rate of around 5% at the moment.
Way above
it's expected
ours.
To come down. That's right. But let's look at it a different way then. Let's look at it in terms of the percent of the economy that they're going to try and shrink public spending by. So at the moment, as I said, they spent just over 47% of output on public services.
Right.
By the end of this cutting package, by the end of this parliament, they expect to be spending 39.5% of GDP on public services. So that's a good about 8 to 9% reduction. But that, funnily enough, will take the public spending as a percentage of the economy back only to the level just above where Labour started in 1997. So there is an element of cutting back a lot of the things that have gone before. Let's look at it another way in terms of what happened to employment over the 13 years of the Labour government. Over the complete period, private sector employment stayed roughly flat. It went up and then in the recession it's gone down again. But over that period, the number of public sector employees has gone up from around 6.5 million to 8.2 million. So the net increase in employment over that long period was entirely in the public sector. And that's where I'm sure the government will be looking to cut back jobs.
I've seen some estimates, Philip, that government spending in the UK accounts for half the workforce there, nearly half the economy. I mean, that's enormous. And it's grown a lot. But at the same time, people are talking about Cameron proposing bigger cuts, more sweeping changes for the UK, even than Margaret Thatcher brought.
Yes, I'm just looking at the figures for Mrs. Thatcher. In the first 5 or 6 years of her government, public spending actually went up as a proportion of the economy. It was only later on, as the economy expanded, that public spending started to come back and the private sector started to grow. But let me tell you exactly what he's thinking about. He is saying that the health service, which is the second biggest spending that the government indulges in, is going to be protected and indeed grow in line with inflation, that international aid is going to grow, and all the savings will come from the other departments. So those other big spending, the biggest single spending is social spending, transfers to the unemployed, to people on pensions. And after that, you get into education, you get into defence, you get into the police and prisons. And these are quite difficult things to cut. And they're proposing, as you said, 25% in real terms cuts, that is, after you allow for inflation. Now, that's quite difficult. Do you get rid of lots of police officers? Do you cut rid of prison officers? Do you cut back on defence spending, when we had a big fuss before the last election about the equipment that our troops were getting in Afghanistan, and the Conservative Party was very critical of the Labour government about that? Do you get rid of teachers? These are very difficult things to cut. And so they've announced that they will try and reduce these spending targets by that amount, but they haven't actually said how yet, and we don't find that out until the autumn.
I mean, the idea of 25% cuts, we look at just a flat budgets or just a 1 or 2% cuts and we get huge uproars here. 25%, that goes to muscle and bone, clearly. That's a change in the profile of public life in the UK.
It is, though, again, if you think about those numbers for public sector employment, that they rose by about 25% in employee terms over the course of the Labour government. I suppose if you just reverse that, you'd be back to where you were in 1997. So, and again, in terms of the amount of money spent as a proportion of economic output, you'd be about where you were before. The economy functioned in 1997 with lower levels of public sector employment. The question is, will the private sector, will normal businesses step up and take on the people who are being laid off from the public sector? And that's going to be the big debate that your two economists will no doubt be having.
We'll hear that. Bankers crying foul also because of tax increases, some the prospect of bonus caps in the UK, and a top income tax rate climbing from 40 to 50%. So it's not just cutbacks, it's also higher taxes, he's talking.
That's right. The 50% tax rate has already come in. They had a bonus tax towards the end of last year. Those are both measures introduced by the Labour government, but the 50% tax rate is not being dropped by the Conservative Prime Minister. We're going to have an increase in our sales tax, which is called VAT, from 17.5% to 20%.
20%?
Yeah.
Wow.
And that's going to raise about £13 billion. Now, the interesting thing about that is that's going to take the bulk of or quite a large proportion of the deficit cutting in the near term. There's lots of talk about cutting public spending, but this whacking great reduction in next year's deficit is being driven by tax, as much by tax rises as public spending.
Does this leave the UK free riding on American stimulus? I mean, our Federal Reserve, our federal government still got a stimulus bent to it. A lot of talk about, you know, cutbacks, but it's still stimulus is the primary posture here. Does that leave you kind of the UK kind of riding on the US economy, attempting to keep pumping, you know, liquidity into the world economy?
You could argue that, and if you look at the government's forecasts of where their growth is going to come from, they're forecasting that trade is going to contribute to growth every year. In other words, our exports are going to grow. So we're going to try and sell our goods to everyone else, including, of course, the Americans, though Europe is our biggest single export market. And that is one of the difficulties, that Europe is also, the rest of Europe is also trying to cut back at a time when we are. So they won't be willing to buy our exports that easily. The other issue you need to think about is the lucky position that the US is in relative to Britain. The US is the biggest single economy in the world. It has the most liquid market, treasury bonds. It is the reserve currency of the world. So the Chinese, the OPEC countries, mm-hmm. naturally buy treasury bonds and they keep them in reserves.
Cameron's message this week, you can do it. We can't. We don't have a reserve currency.
Exactly. They don't have to buy our bonds, and that's why we need to make sure that we are credit worthy.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We are looking with some fascination at Britain this hour, doing what some people are talking about doing in this country, really chopping government back big time, a huge austerity drive on the table with the assent of Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron. He's in Washington this week. Philip Coggan of The Economist is with us from London. Here's a little more of the Prime Minister, British Prime Minister in Washington on Tuesday, talking again with ABC World News' Diane Sawyer, explaining why, in his words, his government plans to make such draconian cuts in public spending.
This year, we are borrowing more than virtually any other country in the G20. We're actually borrowing this more this year than Greece. So it's necessary for Britain to tighten its belt and to prove that we can live within our means. And having won the election on that basis and formed a coalition government on that basis, I want to demonstrate that that's what we're going to do.
So you don't look at the United States in any way say you are continuing to stimulate yourself into a point of no return.
Well, President Obama himself has got plans for quite aggressive budget deficit reduction that I think is going to take your deficit down to 3% of GDP from where it is today by 2015.
The junior partner is not going to scold the United States.
Certainly not. It's for different countries to do things in different ways. We're all heading in the same direction.
The junior partner, maybe, scolding, not. But it looks like a different direction right now. In any case, stimulus still on, more or less, in the U.S., the opposite on in the U.K. Philip Coggan is with us in London. We're joined right now as well from, first from Birmingham in the U.K., by Lord Meghnad Desai, member of the House of Lords, member of the Labour Party, but a supporter of the Cameron government's austerity proposals, Professor Emeritus of Economics at the London School of Economics, author of Marx's Revenge. Lord Meghnad Desai, thank you very much for being with us.
Hello, Tom.
Also with us, and from Hanover, New Hampshire, David Blanchflower is here, former member of the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England. That's the British equivalent of the Federal Reserve. Professor of Economics at the University of Stirling in Scotland and at Dartmouth College here in the U.S. Writes columns all over the place. Has testified against the austerity budget. David Blanchflower, thank you for being with us.
Hello, Tom, and hello, others.
Lord Desai, to you first. Here we are with an austerity budget. You know, in this country, people are still arguing, Paul Krugman and many others, go to austerity and you get your Lord Keynes described as the paradox of thrift. You may actually, you know, take the economy down with austerity. Are you not concerned about that?
No, you see, we got into this mess not because of thrift, but because of overspending and over-indebtedness of consumers. And while we were in deep recession, obviously we had to continue borrowing and deficit spending. But sooner or later, there comes a time when you have to say, well, you know, when are we going to begin to answer the deeper question of the deficit? And I think the Labour government itself, of which I'm a supporter, began to stop the stimulus in the first quarter. They reversed the tax cut, and they have proposed a path of budget deficit cut over the next 5 years. What the Conservatives have done is they've taken that path and shaved off a bit more, so that current spending, excluding government investment, will be constant in real terms. It goes up every year, but only by as much as inflation. I think, in a sense, after 6 years of deficit spending, we started in 2004, I think it's time to call a halt. You can't go on saying more stimulus and we will get out of all this. We have got out. It's a weak recovery, but we'll have to go now strengthen the fundamentals of the system. And consumption expenditure is not the answer.
David Blanchflower, you're calling this new austerity budget rash, warning that it's a major gamble. Why?
Well, I agree with Lord Desai that sooner or later you're going to have to deal with this problem. And my view is probably later rather than sooner. Certainly it makes sense to start to deal with the problem. But let's get realistic. What's actually happened is we have a once in 100 years financial crisis. The reason the UK has been in this position is it's had to rescue lots of banks. It's had reductions in revenue and increases in spending to try and rescue the country, if you like. And the big question is, can you generate growth? You need to get growth first. Once you have growth, then the revenues re-establish themselves. The danger is the economy is on life support. And what the new coalition government are proposing is to instantly remove the life support. And my view is what you should do is take it off gradually, establish growth. The danger is you take off life support of a patient who's gravely ill, they'll die.
Philip Coggan, how's the British public responding to this? This is a big change. Are people lining up with it, against it? Has it come home yet? Do they understand what's happening?
I don't think it's come home yet. George Osborne, who is the finance minister chancellor, is, in one opinion, Paul, the most popular chancellor ever. But that's because the cuts to public spending haven't really hit home yet. The problem is most people will accept that public spending needs to be cut, but not that the bit of their benefits or their services should be cut. And this is a problem that affects all democracies, that people naturally are in favour of lower taxes and higher spending, but those two things don't really square in the long run.
Lord Desai, do you expect, I don't know, strikes and riots when these hundreds of thousands of layoffs begin in the UK?
Yeah, see, this year, for 2010-11, the cuts are very mild indeed. What Osborne has done is taken the Labour government spending limit of $640 billion, pounds, and he has shaved off about £6 to 7 billion out of it. So everybody talks about cuts, but nothing has happened. An advance notice has been given that public sector pay, about £21,000, will be frozen. Benefits will be indexed at a lower rate than usual. Yes, the cuts are going to bite next year. Yes, of course, there will be strikes, there will be trouble. But I think some part of the British public also recognizes that this thing is not going to go away. Just before the election, they saw the Greek riots on that television. And although we are not Greeks by any means, they could see that if they don't support some kind of deficit cut, this may yet be our case. I mean, we've been through this before. The British economy has been through, repeated bouts of deficit spending. It happened in the 1990s when the Tories came to power in 1979. We had hyperinflation and, you know, things like that. You know, tough measures were taken. And when Margaret Thatcher took tough measures, she got re-elected 3 times. So, you know, it is not as if the public in some corner of its mind doesn't understand the need for such things. I think that other chattering classes will go on having the debate. But what I think is advantage of what the government is doing is they have given advance notice, they have not softened the blow, and they have courted unpopularity, and we should see what the consequences are. But somebody has to do it, and Labour Party was unwilling to talk about it before the election. Somebody has to cut the deficit, and I've been saying even before the election that this is a task someone has to perform.
David Blanchflower, Meghna Desai describes the cuts, coming cuts, in mild terms. What do you anticipate when they actually hit the pavement?
Well, I certainly don't think they're mild terms. They're the most draconian cuts that any Western country has seen in a century.
Not this year.
Next year comes soon enough.
But we're in July.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is that Philip's right. Nothing much has changed yet because nothing's been implemented. But the one thing that has happened, a consumer confidence poll taken after the election had a dramatic drop just as it did in the US. So that's the first thing. The second problem is that previous examples where there have been cuts, an example people use are Canada, but that's not comparable because what happened in Canada was that the biggest trading area of the United States to its south was booming and it was able to use monetary policy and lower interest rates. So the UK can't do that. Monetary policy is sitting at the lower bound. There's very little room for manoeuvre. And this government's forecasts for growth are just unbelievably optimistic. So the problem is going to be they're going to try and implement this, assume that the private sector is going to step into the fold and create those jobs. But I think it's extremely unlikely it will do that. So the problem is going to be once the data starts to come in, we're going to have to see a plan B, which is reverse all of this stuff because the economy is going to tank. And that seems a big worry to me.
Is there a plan B?
There's no plan B at all. The Chancellor was asked on Thursday what it was, and he said it was to bring back confidence to the UK economy. Well, that's like economics of crossing your fingers. There is some possibility, and I think the comparison with the US is a good one, that the Bernanke and the MPC have talked about much more quantitative easing. That's about the only plan B. Well, plan C is to reverse all of this nonsense and make sure that growth starts to occur. What we're going to see is a collapse in confidence, a collapse in growth rates, big increases in unemployment, and as Meghna says, social distress, particularly amongst the young. We've got 20% youth unemployment rates already. They can't go to college. We're going to see those numbers rise. So social distress, and I suspect there's going to be a great deal of turning going on.
If I may, we have listeners around the country here eager to join this conversation. Let me begin to bring them in. Jeffrey in Des Moines, Iowa. Jeffrey, you're on the air with our British guests.
Yeah, there's two primary differences between the United States and the UK. Number one, the UK does not have a monstrosity called the Pentagon that swallows $700 billion every year and that is really off limits of the Republicans and Democrats, meaning that when in the United States we talk about balancing the budget, we start by saying half of the budget, the Pentagon,
off the table,
is sacred and off limits, mm-hmm. whereas the UK spends $70 billion. Number two is people in the UK have national health insurance. So in other words, no matter how rough things get, the Brits know they'll always get some health care.
Let us look at those. Philip Coggan, what about it? You've got a different scene. You don't support, you know, the global military reach at the scale anything like the Pentagon, and you've got, you know, health insurance that guarantees that. Does that make it different when the cuts come down for Britons, Philip?
Well, certainly he's right in that the Britons will feel that they won't suffer, their health won't suffer, because the government has guaranteed to maintain health spending in real terms. In defence spending, it's not obviously anything like as big as the Pentagon, but it's still quite a strain on the British budget because they were involved in two wars for several years, which for a relatively small country, trying to support forces in both Iraq and Afghanistan is very difficult. But, of course, our difficulty is that we don't have the luxury that the US has of other people being willing to buy our debt at very cheap levels. And one reason the government did act was they were worried about getting their credit rating downgraded from the agencies, which they were talking about earlier this year.
And that's a real issue in the UK as across Europe right now. Let's go to Mariana, Florida, and Dimitri. Dimitri, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking most like governments that do fall in a category like financially unstable, probably downsizing would be great. If, for instance, I'm just going to go off to a different subject to relate to the situation. For example, if the downsizing let people to be more in control, like, for instance, any bills to be passed, allow it through a similar program, like TV program, like American Idol, but people can vote, and thus will reduce the needs for the people that make the bill.
You want to put up an American Idol for government spending cuts? That would be fascinating to see.
No, like similar programs, like TV programs where they bring revenue, but also do the jobs. Like many bills you ask, like every now and then officials, you know, sort of taunt each other, like so-and-so didn't sign the bill, but they didn't read it.
Right, so let's put them right out there on the stage and see how the public responds. Fascinating. You know, President Obama this week, Lord Desai may come to you. He was standing with David Cameron at his side and sounding fairly Keynesian. And he said that the world cannot rely on an economic model in which the U.S. borrows, consumers in the U.S. borrow, we take out home equity lines, we run up credit cards to purchase goods from all around the world. We cannot alone, said the U.S. president, we cannot alone be the economic engine for the rest of the world's growth. What about that argument, Lord Desai?
Well, you know, I'm sorry. The world has passed on. The U.S. is no longer the engine of the world. It's China and India. I mean, this is the big dilemma that the developed countries are going to face. When the recovery is done, they're going to find that they are outsmarted and outrun where the real manufacturing growth, the real innovations are going. You know, GEC and Siemens are finding out the Chinese are making much better machines than they are. So while we are discussing consumption-led booms, and I believe that government spending has very low multipliers, we can debate that, the real foundations of sustained growth are not being laid. And, you know, yes, and it's no longer the case that America is going to be the growth engine or the buyer of the last resort. America doesn't have the money, and the Chinese will not go on lending it that much. You know, the last 8-10 years have been a Chinese-financed boom in America. You've got to stop. You can't go on like this. You know, it's totally irresponsible.
David Blanchflower, do you agree U.S. spending, that famous one-time at least engine, a sideshow now?
I think that's completely nonsense. If we look back... in 2007, the whole thing started, the whole of this Great Recession started in the U.S. and then spread around the world. To argue that the U.S. is sort of irrelevant seems to me sort of strange.
Well,
it also seems, let me finish, it also seems to be true that China, well, it seems to be true that China actually is slowing. But I want to make a couple of points about borrowing.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing is that the U.K. is actually borrowing money perfectly well. It's conducting its auctions. It's borrowing money at 3.33% on 10-year gilts. There's no evidence whatsoever that the UK is actually like Greece. None at all.
Your Prime Minister certainly doesn't agree with that. And the ratings agency has been working their way down the list of EU governments.
Well,
they've been cutting credit ratings.
Paul Krugman called that argument, and I like his phrase, he calls it utter folly dressed up as wisdom. I wrote up a column the other day which said, no, that's not true. The World Bank vote says that Greece is the most difficult place in the OECD to do business in. It doesn't have a sensible fiscal regime. There's huge amounts of corruption. So Greece is demonstrably not like the UK, partly because we have an independent central bank, we have our own exchange rate, and the government can actually operate quantitative easing. So there's no evidence whatsoever that Greece is the UK. And then secondly, countries like Greece and like Ireland that have taken this kind of sets of measures, it turns out that the market's turned against them. So Ireland is a good example. Ireland did this, and I opposed this in a set of lectures a year or so ago, and now all of a sudden Ireland's taken the role that the UK's done, and suddenly the markets have turned on them because of all the measures that are implemented. These impact growth.
No,
Meghna's right.
That is because the banks, Irish banks, have got a lot of toxic debt. It's not because of deficit. You know, the rating agents turned against Ireland because they looked at the toxic debt which has been piled up in a bad bank. And it turns out that it is much more toxic than anybody else.
Well, you're right.
It's nothing to do with the budget deficit.
Well, I'm looking here at the Bloomberg Business Week in the UK is saying, Lord Desai, that if Cameron blinks on the cuts, the UK may have its credit rating cut. If he forges ahead with the cuts, they're saying you could be back in recession.
My point is, even if the rating agencies did not downgrade us, we should think whether we should go on borrowing like this, because government spending multipliers are extremely low, and to have a growth revival through government consumer spending will take at least 2 to 3 years of deficit spending.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the drastic change of course on debt in Britain, gigantic cutbacks in government spending in the UK, and how they look from the US. Philip Coggan of The Economist is with us, as is David Blanchflower, former member of the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England, their equivalent of the Federal Reserve there, and Lord Meghna Desai, member of the House of Lords, member of the Labour Party, but a big supporter of Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron's quite austere budget proposals. We have a lot of response to the three of you, my esteemed guests, online here. Rex says, this is the most sensible and easy way to save money. It's like stepping back 70 years and managing our finances in a responsible manner. Of course, 70 years ago was the Depression. Nick says, austerity measures don't affect the wealthy. Such action will negatively impact the poor, elderly, the majority middle class. The only way to really address national deficit is to increase taxation on the wealthy. And on Facebook, Ronald says, could the U.S. stomach these measures? No. And there's this, and let me put this to you, David Blanchflower. Joel says England's deficit represents 10% of their GDP, the U.S. deficit 5% of our GDP. I'm not sure about those numbers, but even he says if we found the political will to make cuts like this, it would be overkill. Would anything like, you don't think it makes sense for the U.K.? Could it make sense for the U.S.,
well,
David?
No, I don't think it makes sense. I mean, the worry I have in my mind is what happened in 1937 in the U.S., where tightening occurred too quickly. That pushed us into double dip. The problem is that in both the U.S. and in the U.K., banks are still compromised. They're still not lending. And I was struck very much this week by things that Bernanke said yesterday about small firms not lending and similar mood music in the U.K. Mm-hmm. Banks are simply not lending. And one thing I should just and we're going to have stress tests coming out tomorrow. But one thing I should pick Philip up on, which wasn't quite right in what he said, that there has been a big growth in the public sector. But in the U.K., a lot of the reason for that in recent times is because the government actually rescued RBS, Royal Bank of Scotland. Mm-hmm. It rescued Lloyds. It rescued Northern Rock.
That was expensive.
And once it once it rescued them, it turned out that employment went from the private sector to the public sector. So the public sector growth was actually about risk, a big chunk of it, 250,000 jobs with it. So it just seems to me that when you're in a position that the banks are not lending, we're going to see how seriously stress tests are tomorrow, it really does compromise the ability for the private sector to grow. And the arguments that the Tory government are making with its coalition partner, who didn't actually say that they would do this when they actually went to the election, mm-hmm. they're just making very, very dangerous moves, it seems to me.
Let me go to Mike in Waltham, Massachusetts. Mike, what do you think? What's your question?
Listening to this conversation over the past several months, it seems to me that the premise of cutbacks and deficit reduction is that economic growth will sort of take up the slack in the economy.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, where is that growth going to come from? Lord Desai earlier had mentioned something about consumption is not going to be able to be the answer. And so that seems to be a bigger question than just simply deficit reduction. What is the sort of the next era of economic growth going to look like? Where is it going to come from?
Meghna Desai.
Yes, well, very simply, consumption is not going to be the key, because a lot of government spending has been saved by the consumers because they want to retire their debt. And so multipliers, at least in the UK, are very low. I think sooner or later there will have to be a private investment revival, because that is where growth comes from. Growth doesn't come from consumption. Growth comes from investment. And, you know, everybody says, oh, this will not happen. But in the 1990s, the UK economy went through exactly a very similar period. There was a massive cut in the budget deficit, and the slack was taken up by the private sector. Now, you know, I mean, everybody goes back to 1937. I go back to the 1990s in the UK, and we had a good switchover between public sector and private sector. So we don't have to go back to the 1937.
So private investment.
I think multipliers are low because UK is an open economy. People are saving quite a lot. And given the built-in stabilizers, the multipliers cannot be very large.
We've got a caller on this front in Mansfield, Connecticut. Fred, you're on the air.
I'm delighted with the question from Massachusetts, and the piece got it right, is we have to get investment. Martin Wolf and today Jeffrey Sachs in the Financial Times have been talking about that all these strategies, whether encouraging consumption or cutting deficits, both of them are bad strategies. Neither of them, in fact, addresses the issue. And I'm an economic historian, and a reference to 1937 is just dead bad not. There is an enormous danger here of both cutting back too soon, of too much emphasis on consumption. We have huge needs on the investment front, and I'm talking public sector investment. I mean, you know, the United States has over $1 trillion in infrastructure demands. We, you know, you look at our international ratings, whether it's human capital investment or infrastructure, we're in very bad shape. We're falling back. Jeffrey Sachs talks about, you know, all the things the Chinese are actually doing, and what we do in the U.S. is talk.
Fred, let us pick it up right there, if you'd be good enough. Philip Coggan, if I may, I mean, I'm looking at here, survey in the U.K. This is from Wales Online, but it's saying that the business leaders like this there. I mean, in this country, private business is sitting on, you know, trillions, not really making that investment right now. Will an austerity budget bring out investment in the U.K., Philip?
Well, we have to hope it will do. I mean, the point about public investment in infrastructure would be a very good one for Britain. Anyone who's visited London would know that our infrastructure needs updating. The trouble is that isn't where the bulk of the deficit is going. There's some money being spent on the Olympics, which we're hosting in 2012, but there's an awful lot of infrastructure which could be improved. But the most of the money and the public sector deficit goes on benefits. It doesn't go to rebuild our railways or our roads. And I'm afraid that, as Lord Desai mentioned, much though it might be right in theory that we can use deficits to improve the economy, in practice it doesn't always happen.
David, do you see private investment stepping up then in the UK to fill the void?
No, I agree both with Meghna and Philip that actually investment is crucial. But the problem for the government is that in their forecast, they assume not only is it crucial, but it will happen and happen quickly. So if you just look at their forecast, it says investment fell by 20% in 2009. It's going to pick up to 1% this year. And then from then onwards, it's going to be a growth of 10% every year. And I don't think that there's any possibility that that's going to take the place. But I absolutely agree with them. We should be moving from consumption to investment expenditure, trying to encourage private sector growth and also private sector job creation. The forecast that the government has actually says we'll kill off 1.6 million jobs with this 1.3 million jobs with this measure. But the private sector in 4.5 years will step in and create 2.5 million jobs, even though in the boom years 2000 to 2008 it created 1.6 million. So this is all incredibly optimistic. Philip and Meghna are completely right. You need to move to investment. The worry is you're not going to do it quick enough, and then these plans are going to come crashing down because unemployment will rise, output will fall dramatically. You need to do this, but being able to do this in a 15-month period is just unrealistic.
Let me ask you about the cultural angle of this. I mean, this is a big change for the direction of the UK after a long time going the other way. David Cameron, Prime Minister, Conservative, talking now about what he calls the big society. I've seen it described as a strategy to train volunteers in communities for different public service jobs so the British government, this is Ned Resnikoff writing, so the British government can scale back its own role in providing those services. Here's Cameron talking about this conservative Tory vision of a big society, a dramatic redistribution of power from, quoting him, the elite in Whitehall to the man and woman in the street. Philip Coggan, is that Britain's putting their hands up and saying, yes, we've had enough of this, we want that?
Well, it sounds very like George Bush the First's 1,000 Points of Light and George Bush the Second's Compassionate Conservatism, doesn't it? It's the argument that the state can't do everything.
But also so therefore, a Ronald Reagan and a kind of a Thatcher sound in there.
Yes, it does. And, you know, it's certainly the case that lots of people would like to decide things locally rather than have them decided by central government. The difficulty is if you allow that to happen, then local provision will be quite different from one place to the other. And then governments get blamed by the newspapers or by society in general for wide ranges in provision between one part of the country and another. And that's a difficulty that all people who believe in localism face. What happens if that bit of the country, the private sector doesn't step up? Is the government surely has to keep going in those bits of the country?
Meghna Desai, how about it? You're a Labour guy, but you want the cutbacks. Prime Minister Cameron's talking about saying he wants to end this time when people became passive recipients of state help and communities who, according him, were soulless clones of one another. But what about, you know, there are uneven resources in any society. What about the cultural change here?
No, I think Philip is quite right. You know, governments, when they come in power, say, oh, we are going to give power away to people. We do very much local stuff. But the British public doesn't like diversity in provision. They really get very upset, you know, what they call postcode lottery. You know, when one area has better things. I think it is a country so small that centralization is very easy. And even the Cameron government, sort of 18 months down the line, is going to abandon the big society and do the good old thing of centralizing power. Especially when you're cutting money, you can't actually decentralize, because decentralization requires a bit of money. I think they will come to their senses. I've no faith in big society. I think that's a lot of hogwash. But I think what is, they will have to face the consequences of what they're doing. And I think they should know that there will be riots in the streets. I know it is going to be. But basically, a society which has indulged itself for 10 years in overspending has to kind of get more economical. I mean, I don't see what the problem is. We all have to do it, and societies have to do these things.
Philip, speaking of cultural angles, we learn here, I mean, the Queen is saying this week she's going to make cutbacks, and, who knew that she had a royal piper who played under her window in the mornings and an official counter of swans. They're going to cut back on patching or re-roofing Buckingham Palace and won't take out the asbestos. I mean, is this a thoroughgoing sort of everybody's going to pinch their pennies, Philip?
Yes, that's the plan. And the Queen, of course, is famously quite thrifty. She eats her cereal out of Tupperware containers.
Oh, dear.
And we've already lost the royal yacht and the royal train over the years. So she's used to having the pennies pinched. But she'll get by, I think. She's got a few castles and plenty of paintings.
A few. Exactly. Let's go to Marianne in Providence, Rhode Island. Marianne, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a couple of points. Mm-hmm. I have a friend and colleague who returned from a 1,000-mile road trip in England just a week ago, and right. I have a half-sister living in England.
Yep.
My friend commented that compared to our roads, the English roads from the tiniest little lanes all the way through the big ones around London are absolutely fabulous. She said you could roller skate on them compared to our roads.
Yeah.
And my half-sister in England, her husband recently had a hip operation, and they sent her, the government health care sent her, to Ireland for a week's vacation because they feel that caretakers need to be taken care of, too. Now, just those two areas comparing English society and culture to American.
Marianne, thanks. David Blanchflower, maybe you can afford cutbacks. Maybe you're in such great ship shape, your roads and hips and nurses and...
Well, your friends probably didn't go to London where there's
said they did. I don't know.
Yeah,
well that's work.
London's
though.
Pretty bad. But one of the things we should say is that one of the departments that's going to really, really hit by these cuts is actually going to be the transport department. So we're going to see a real cut back there. I actually want a couple of things that other folks brought up. I think in the U.S. context, what's going to happen in the U.K. if you cut the public sector? What happens in the UK is that some regions are really hurt much more than others. So places like Wales and Scotland and the North East are much more dependent on the public sector. So even if you cut there and you create wealth and investment and jobs in the country, it may well not be in those places. So the danger is that you end up increasing how much inequality and changing the nature of services in various parts of the country. So transport's going to get hit. The health service to this point is going to be protected, but a lot of people are saying, why should it be?
Marianne, I don't know if that will satisfy you, but there's a piece. Let's go to Judy in Oxford, Iowa. Judy, you're on the air.
Thank you. I just want to say 3 cheers for the Brits. They have the right priorities. They want health care, so they get it. We want war, so we get it. They raise taxes on the rich. We're going to raise unemployment, and it's not the private sector that can save us. Their job is to make money. If you want to create jobs, the government has to hire teachers, build roads, build bridges.
But where's the money finally come from, Judy, if the private sector doesn't generate wealth?
You tax the rich and the corporations. You surely realize that there are a lot of corporations that don't even pay taxes. In fact, they get subsidies.
Yeah, we know that side as well. I appreciate your call. One more. Lucy in Methuen, Massachusetts. Lucy, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I kind of agree with the callers. The problem today is the 17% unemployment. If we're supposed to start spending, who's to spend the money? The rich are spending, but they're not investing because they really, it's just the jobs. we need more jobs, and we need people to go back to work, but not the jobs of 1937. Then we gave people a shovel, and they build roads, and they build highways, and they build dams. But today we need jobs of tomorrow, so we need more teachers. We can't have everybody working at McDonald's.
Not at McDonald's. We could use more roads. Can't all be teachers. Lord Desai, where do you see the next generation of jobs coming in the
well,
UK?
Absolutely. I think there will have to be lots of jobs in green technology. We'll have to restore our infrastructure. We'll have to restore or reshape our education system, all those things. But I think eventually we'll also have to realize that we will have to pay more costs of what we do and borrow less. Because in the medium to long run, a deficit-financed boom is not sustainable. But I think if we can borrow and invest in infrastructure or research and technology, that would be the answer. I'm certainly not in favor of consumption spending by the government of any kind.
David Blanchflower, what's your timetable for assessing how this new austerity is going to work? When will we know if it's getting the UK's economy back up on the rails or into the ditch?
Well, I think we're going to start seeing the data coming in. I've been writing various columns about it. We're going to, in the UK, get some data tomorrow on GDP. But I think the big things will be what's happened to consumer spending, what's happening to unemployment, and what's the government going to do if the data turn out to be pretty bad? And that's the question. So I think we just have to watch the data and see how quickly they're going to have to reverse course, which I suspect within about 9 months they're going to have to.
Well, we will be watching. It's been a fascinating insights for all of us here, and we're grateful to each of you. Lord Meghna Desai joining us from Birmingham in the UK. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
David Blanchflower joining us today from Hanover, New Hampshire at Dartmouth College there. Thank you very much, David.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
And Philip Coggan, columnist, Buttonwood columnist with The Economist in London today. Philip, thank you so much for your time and insights.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thank you for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.